A July 1967 study found only a modest drop to 85% and 73%, respectively. Although H&I use later declined, the tactic continued into the next decade. The idea behind H&I was to expend munitions, not men. And the same mindset prevailed when it came to all types of artillery support. For instance, it was not out of the ordinary for U.S. troops in Vietnam to blast a whole village or bombard a wide area in an effort to kill a single sniper. One U.S. general coined a dictum in relation to artillery use in Vietnam: waste ammunition like a millionaire and lives like a miser. Even while commanders in the field, eager to please the Pentagon, used search and destroy patrols as bait for guerrillas, when it came to artillery, the war managers in Washington focused almost exclusively on the lives of U.S. soldiers. They paid little attention to the effect of overwhelming firepower on Vietnamese civilians, despite the insistence that they were in the business of winning hearts and minds. The CBS News correspondent John Lawrence remembered two officials from the State Department bitterly complaining to him about harassment and interdiction fire. They explained that the targets were chosen by local South Vietnamese officials who gave grid coordinates to American artillery officers who had only a vague idea what they were shooting at. Sometimes the targets were villages whose farmers had not paid taxes to local government bureaucrats or were suspected of being sympathetic to the VC. The two officials called H&I inhuman and criminal and said that it was killing and injuring Vietnamese who had nothing to do with the war other than being caught in it. Most shelling took place at night, and it made the peasants crazy with fear. Sometimes military officers agreed. In a secret communique to other generals, the top Marine commander, Lieutenant General Robert Cushman, admitted that H&I is one of the primary causes of civilian casualties. Another general more bluntly called it madness. Almost any excuse could justify artillery strikes. The commander of the 25th Infantry Division, General Ellis Williamson, explicitly rejected the principle of proportionality, a tenet of the laws of war that requires the amount of force used to be proportional to the threat posed and advantage gained, and instituted a devastatingly disproportionate reprisal policy. One U.S. advisor who walked through a hamlet in Hau Nha Province near the 25th Infantry Division's post in late 1968 summed up the results. The first area was still close to the American base, and thus nearly two-thirds of the houses had burned. Several of the old women seemed very bitter and talked very little. Apparently, the 25th Division has a policy of 1,000 outgoing for every one incoming. In this village, the people were terrified. I asked them how long things had been this way. They replied, ever since the American base was built. Even more extreme, as the New Yorker magazine reporter Jonathan Schell noted, were policies dictating that artillery be fired at regular intervals, regardless of any military justification. An artillery battery commander explained, "The ammo kept coming whether or not we had targets for it, so the batteries fired their allotments every opportunity they had, whether there was actually anything to shoot at or not." In all, the United States expended close to 30 billion pounds of munitions in Southeast Asia over the course of the war. At the peak of its effort, in 1970, the U.S. was using up 128,400 tons of munitions per month. By comparison, the Revolutionary Forces never fired more than 1,000 tons per month. By the early 1970s, years before the war's end, South Vietnam's landscape was already pockmarked with an estimated 21 million craters, some of them 20 feet or more across. Analyzing the effects of the tremendous firepower of U.S. forces, two South Vietnamese generals wrote, "Many villages were completely obliterated. Houses were reduced to rubble. Innocent people were killed. Untold numbers became displaced. Rice land was abandoned, and as much as one-half of the population of the countryside fled." The cratering of South Vietnam also produced a cascade of environmental effects. Huge numbers of rice paddies, orchards, farms, and gardens were lost to cultivation. This led to rampant erosion and weed invasion, destroyed wildlife habitats, and played havoc with the countryside's intricate irrigation systems. Craters in the more tropical Mekong Delta and those in the coastal regions tended to remain flooded year-round, becoming mosquito breeding grounds and thus sources of disease. What's more, according to post-war estimates, at least 12 million acres of forest were subjected to saturation bombing. Many trees crucial to Vietnam's rubber and timber industries were destroyed. Others were filled with metal fragments, which made them more susceptible to fungal rot or unusable altogether. In addition to such environmentally devastating side effects of the war, the U.S. military deliberately sprayed more than 70 million liters of herbicidal agents, most notably Agent Orange, across the countryside. When plants absorbed the herbicides, their leaves rapidly shriveled and dried up. "The effects appeared overnight," wrote a South Vietnamese colonel about defoliants that drifted across orchards and farms in Bien Hoa province. "Fruit fell from the trees, and the rubber trees in the large nearby plantations turned brown and lost their leaves." He noted that the aerial spraying took an especially heavy toll on custard apples, mango, jackfruit, pineapples, and other economically important crops. Vietnamese farmers also worried about the chemicals' effects on their livestock and their families. They had good reason to be concerned. One American observer who visited a village following a defoliation mission in 1970 reported that, of the 10,000 chickens in the hamlet, 5,000 were subsequently sick and about 1,000 chicks died. Of the 200 pigs, 100 pigs were sick and 15 died. The chickens did not eat, and upon death they ran in circles. "We drove to the village and saw that defoliation had taken place. It must have been 5 weeks ago, because many dried leaves were still hanging on trees. About 10 to 20% of the trees were defoliated. All Autocarpus integrifolia, jackfruit, looked defoliated. Some of the lower leaves of the banana trees were dead. The leaves of mangoes were shriveled, and vegetables were affected." Only you can prevent forests. A play on the Smokey the Bear slogan about forest fires was the dark motto of the troops who carried out ecocide in the previously verdant country. It was obvious to anyone who cared to look, though, that forests were only a small fraction of the story. According to Hamlet census data, toxic defoliants were sprayed on as many as 4.8 million Vietnamese. Immediate reactions to exposure included nausea, cramps, and diarrhea. In the longer term, the defoliants have been associated with higher incidence of stillbirths, as well as a variety of illnesses, including cancers and birth defects, such as anencephaly and spina bifida. Children born decades after the war still suffer the after effects. More broadly, defoliation begat hunger and privation and caused a rupture in the fabric of rural civic life. Toxic herbicides turned formerly emerald-colored areas into bare white zones where nothing but invasive weeds would grow for years. Lush green paddy fields where rice was cultivated, the very center of Vietnamese rural life, were deliberately targeted, in many cases severing an almost sacred connection that bound the Vietnamese to their land. In 1965, 42% of all chemical defoliants sprayed in South Vietnam were aimed at food crops, and the country quickly went from rice exporter to rice importer. A 1967 analysis by the RAND Corporation, an Air Force-sired think tank with strong military ties, concluded that the civilian population seems to carry very nearly the full burden of the results of the crop destruction program. It is estimated that over 500 civilians experience crop loss for every ton of rice denied the VC. American war planners expected that this crop loss would play into the policy of pacification, helping to drive villagers out of areas of the countryside controlled by the NLF and into areas controlled by the Saigon government. But many peasants remained in their ancestral hamlets, even as children grew rail-thin and their parents became increasingly desperate. Army veteran John Beitzel watched as defoliants blanketed valleys and noted the human toll. His unit would dump garbage from their base camp outside a nearby village, he wrote, and the local Vietnamese would almost immediately start eating whatever was there, because they just didn't have enough food. Before we were there, they did, and now that we were there supposedly helping them, they didn't. By 1970, the food supplies of at least 600,000 people had been disrupted by the defoliation campaign, according to a report released by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. As with other facets of the American project in Vietnam, when it came to ecological destruction, overkill was the operative word. From 1965 to 1967, for example, massive fires set by U.S. forces reportedly wiped out about 100,000 acres of forest. Powerful bulldozers known as Rome plows almost systematically attacked the landscape. In 1967, Lieutenant Colonel John Manning of the 168th Combat Engineer Battalion bragged that his clearing blades could flatten 10 to 12 acres per day, and that was just a fraction of the heavy machinery active in Vietnam at the time. In 1971, massive 20-ton Caterpillar tractors tore into parts of the Boi Loi Woods, an area northwest of Saigon that had already been defoliated, bombed, and burned. In 26 days, they cleared 6,037 acres. In all, American bulldozers may have torn up and plowed under as much as 2% of the entire land area of South Vietnam. Bulldozers, heavy tanks, and other armored vehicles were also employed to destroy orchards, paddies, individual homes, and even whole hamlets. A more common way of destroying villages, though, was fire. When U.S. troops took casualties near populated areas, Major General George O'Connor wrote, "The instant reaction of the troops was to burn the whole hamlet down. Burn the damn gooks out. Burn it, and they can't ever come back," was the order handed down as a Marine patrol on a search-and-destroy mission used their Zippo cigarette lighters to torch a hamlet filled with civilians and all their worldly possessions. The slaughter of animals was another key component of the American program of destruction. Upon entering a hamlet, U.S. soldiers often headed straight for the animal pens to liquidate the locals' livestock, killing chickens, ducks, and pigs en masse. Most disastrous of all were the killings of expensive water buffalo. Sometimes the water boo, as U.S. troops called them, were shot dead when, enraged by the presence of outsiders, they charged soldiers and Marines. On other occasions, they were killed simply for sport or out of spite. And frequently, destruction of the large horned beasts was carried out systematically as part of the larger campaign to drive Vietnamese from their paddy fields where water buffalo functioned as living tractors. In 1970, veteran Richard Brummett, who had served in A Troop, 1st Squadron, 1st Cavalry Regiment, wrote a letter to Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird, calling upon him to take action against those responsible for the wanton violence he witnessed. Brummett told Laird that his unit did perform on a regular basis random murder, rape, and pillage upon the Vietnamese civilians in Quang Tin province with the full knowledge, consent, and participation of our troop commander, a Captain David Rossler. These incidents included random shelling of villages with 90-millimeter white phosphorus rounds, machine gunning of civilians who had the misfortune to be near when we hit a mine, torture of prisoners, destroying of food and livestock of the villagers if we deemed they had an excess, and numerous burnings of villages for no apparent reason. What seemed so senseless and shocking to the young veteran, however, was just the overkill mindset in action. Even when their homes were bombarded and their rice fields destroyed, most South Vietnamese villagers were reluctant to move to government-run concentration zones. A significant portion of them instead headed to the cities. Saigon's population nearly tripled after the American assault on the countryside began, and squalid shantytowns sprang up on the outskirts of almost every provincial and district capital. The urban slums were filthy, overcrowded, disease-ridden, and desperately impoverished, but they did for a while offer one key advantage, a respite from the bombs, shells, helicopter gunships, and search-and-destroy ground patrols. In urban areas, U.S. troops still killed civilians in shootings, bar fights, and traffic accidents, but large-scale attacks were relatively rare. Then came 1968. On January 29th, the eve of Tet, the Vietnamese Lunar New Year, a holiday so important that both North and South Vietnam traditionally declared a several-day ceasefire for the festivities, a top U.S. embassy official named George Jacobson threw a gala party on the lawn of his French villa. Jacobson's swanky digs were located in a walled 4-acre compound on Saigon's Embassy Row. In front of them was the new multi-million-dollar U.S. embassy, completed a few months earlier, a 6-story fortress of reinforced concrete walls, solid teak doors, and a large terracotta sunscreen that doubled as a blast shield. On this night, Saigon's foremost citizens, South Vietnamese government officials, and U.S. civilian and military power brokers, including Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker, were enjoying the smooth sounds of a band and the staccato rat-a-tat of a 23-foot-long string of firecrackers set off to scare away evil spirits for the new year. A gift from a top South Vietnamese official, the noisemakers signaled a newfound confidence. For years, traditional firecrackers at Tet had been forbidden to prevent the revolutionary forces from using the sound as a cover for gunfire. Now it seemed there was no need to worry. More than 492,000 American troops were stationed in the country, and victory, if not yet in plain sight, seemed a foregone conclusion. "I have never been more encouraged in my 4 years in Vietnam," General William Westmoreland had announced just 2 months earlier, when he and Bunker had gone to Washington to brief President Lyndon Johnson. The ambassador had assured Johnson and the American people that the Republic of Vietnam now held sway over 67% of the country's population, while the NLF controlled only 17%, and more gains were expected in 1968. Viet Cong recruitment, Bunker reported, had sagged by as much as 50% over the course of 1967, and Saigon's troops were performing better than ever. Westmoreland added that 45% of enemy forces were not fit for combat, and let slip that in 2 years the United States might begin a phase-out of its troops. "We've reached an important point when the end begins to come into view," the general told the National Press Club in Washington. There finally was a light at the end of the tunnel. Before it got too late, Bunker left Jacobson's party and headed back to his own villa. 24 hours later, festive fireworks again rang out across the city. But at 3 a.m. on January 31st, Bunker's Marine guards woke him with startling news. Saigon was under attack. There was no time for the ambassador to get dressed. Bunker threw on a bathrobe, hustled into an armored personnel carrier, and was driven away. Behind him, smoke poured from his study as Marines burned secret documents in case the house fell to the enemy. 6,000 revolutionary fighters, the same guerrilla forces that had been given last rites by Bunker and Westmoreland all autumn long, had infiltrated the South Vietnamese capital and its suburbs, and a tiny commando unit had set its sights on the shiny new American embassy. "They're coming in. Help me," a military policeman at the embassy shouted into his radio. Seconds later, he was dead. Jacobson, the party host, found himself trapped on the second floor of his villa when an injured guerrilla took refuge on the ground floor. U.S. troops tossed a pistol and a gas mask to Jacobson through a window and fired tear gas into his home. He eventually outdueled the wounded fighter and made it out alive. U.S. credibility, however, did not survive the night. The American embassy was just one of the seemingly untouchable Saigon landmarks attacked by the guerrillas. Revolutionary fighters similarly assaulted the Independence Palace, South Vietnam's version of the U.S. White House. Guerrillas also took over the studio of the government radio station, attacked the South Vietnamese Navy's headquarters, and struck Thanh Son Nhut, Saigon's mammoth air base and military complex, the nerve center of the war effort. "The enemy is inside the base," South Vietnam's Vice President Nguyen Cao Ky, who lived at Thanh Son Nhut, screamed into the phone, pleading for reinforcements. "They're less than 500 meters from my house." The fighting in the capital would ultimately go on for more than a month. It took 6.5 hours for the U.S. military to finally secure the embassy compound. During the battle, guerrillas exchanged shots with U.S. military police, while 101st Airborne Division paratroopers landed on the embassy roof. Journalists also flocked to the scene. An assault on one of the foremost symbols of American power in Vietnam was too big a story to pass up. They were shocked by what they found. The new complex, featured in puff pieces just a few months before, was now a war zone. American troops and armed personnel in civilian attire were running and crouching for cover on the manicured lawn, huddling against ornamental trees and decorative fountains. The bodies of dead U.S. troops lay sprawled in the street out front. Vietnamese corpses littered the compound lawn. There was a gaping hole in the blast wall, and bullet scars were everywhere. And then there was General Westmoreland. With U.S. troops still blowing up unexploded grenades in the background, the general stood ready for TV cameras in neatly pressed fatigues, 4 silver stars on each lapel, and his olive-green baseball cap on his head. Speaking as if he were at a routine stateside press conference, the bushy-eyebrowed commander castigated the enemy for very deceitfully taking advantage of the Tet truce. He said that their efforts were aimed at creating maximum consternation and claimed that attacks on Saigon and other cities were just a diversion from the real target, an isolated and long-besieged marine outpost at Khe San in the desolate northern mountains near the DMZ and the border with Laos. In reality, the exact opposite was the case. The siege of Khe San had been a Vietnamese diversion designed to pin down U.S. troops at a lonely outpost while guerrillas snuck into key cities and towns. Even though guerrillas were still holding significant parts of the capital, Westmoreland sounded as confident as ever as he stood before the cameras. But after months of cheery talk about a weakened enemy and with American vulnerability on display for all the world to see, he appeared bizarrely out of touch, if not utterly delusional. As Don Oberdorfer of the Washington Post put it, the reporters could hardly believe their ears. Westmoreland was standing in the ruins and saying everything was great. The attack on Saigon, it turned out, was part of a coordinated strategy. Revolutionary forces struck four other major cities, 35 of 44 provincial capitals, 64 district seats, and 50 other locations throughout South Vietnam. Hoping to spark a popular uprising, guerrillas and North Vietnamese regulars dug in wherever they could. This left the American forces with two options: fight at close quarters, house by house, to dislodge small bands of sappers and individual guerrillas, or broadly target great swaths of cities and towns as they had long targeted the countryside. The United States chose the latter. We'd been trying for years to get them to come out in the open so we could slaughter them, and we slaughtered them. That was how John Singlaub, the commander of a clandestine U.S. Special Operations Force known as MACV-SOG, summed up the Tet counteroffensive. "I've never seen so many dead people stacked up." The counteroffensive treated crowded cities as free fire zones, with devastating results. As the journalist Neil Sheehan observed, saving of the soldiers' lives was not the principal reason for the lack of restraint. It was more in the nature of a reflex to turn loose on the urban centers the stomp-them-to-death firepower that had brutalized the Vietnamese countryside. U.S. troops secured their own embassy floor by floor, but they employed more sweeping methods elsewhere. Bombs, shells, and rockets pounded entire residential neighborhoods, leaving nothing but smoldering rubble. In the streets, everyone was fair game. An American official recorded what happened to one South Vietnamese Army veteran whose home caught fire in the fighting. The veteran, in attempting to drag some of his belongings to safety on Nguyen Van Thoi Street, ran into American soldiers who called on him to stop, in English. The veteran failed to heed the Americans and was shot dead. He lay for 3 days in the entrance to Lane 177 before sanitation crews took away the body. In Saigon and its suburbs, around 6,300 civilians died and 11,000 were wounded. Some 19,000 dwellings were destroyed, more than 125,000 people were left homeless, and 206,000 Saigon residents became refugees. According to a U.S. Military Inspector General's report, most of the damage in the capital was caused by U.S. forces. Hue, South Vietnam's third-largest city and once the imperial capital of the country, also suffered severely. While Westmoreland had focused most of his pre-Tet attention on Khe San, the revolutionary forces had quietly withdrawn two regiments that had been laying siege to the outpost and sent them over the mountains to join in the attack on Hue. For 25 days, they held large portions of the city and carried out one of the most notorious and well-publicized atrocities of the war, pre-planned, targeted executions of select officials, military personnel, and others loyal to the Republic of Vietnam. According to a captured document, during this occupation, the Revolutionary Forces eliminated 1,892 administrative personnel, 38 policemen, 790 tyrants, 6 captains, 2 first lieutenants, 20 second lieutenants, and many non-commissioned officers. In all, 3,000 or more people may have been killed in the massacre. As U.S. and South Vietnamese forces launched a counterattack to take back the city, another bloodbath commenced. Reporting on the Marines as they fought street to street, the CBS television correspondent John Lawrence asked Lieutenant Colonel Ernie Cheatham what would happen to innocents trapped between them and the guerrillas. "I'm pretty sure there are civilians we would consider bad guys right now," Cheatham replied. Navy ships lobbed 7,670 shells into Hue, and Marine Corps aircraft flew dozens of sorties, dropping napalm and 500-pound bombs on residential neighborhoods. In all, U.S. forces unleashed an astonishing 600 tons of bombs, plus barrages from artillery and tank cannons, dismantling the city in a chorus of explosions while ground troops fought street to street. "We used everything but nuclear weapons on this town," said one Marine. Another admitted, "A great many civilians must have died in the fighting. If you saw or heard, or thought you saw or heard, movement in the house next door, you didn't stop to knock, you just tossed in a grenade." At least 3,800 of Hue's citizens were killed or reported missing as a result of the bombardment and battle, and 116,000 people were made homeless. More than three-quarters of the city's homes were destroyed or seriously damaged. "Nothing I saw during the Korean War or in the Vietnam War so far has been as terrible in terms of destruction and despair as what I saw in Hue," wrote the correspondent Robert Chaplin. Cheatham, the commander of the 2nd Battalion, 5th Marines, put it more simply, "We pretty much destroyed the place, I guess." The brutality of the Tet counteroffensive became front-page news around the world when the National Police Chief, General Nguyen Ngoc Luan, strode up to an unarmed, bound prisoner on a Saigon street, leveled his revolver, and put a bullet in the man's brain. The scene was captured by the Associated Press photographer Eddie Adams and by an NBC television camera, and the shockingly close-range killing, the gun just a few inches from the prisoner's temple, a grimace on his face at the moment of impact, blood spurting like a fountain in the video footage as the prisoner crumpled to the ground, became an indelible image of the war. Such summary executions were commonplace. A U.S. Army investigation, for example, looked into allegations that a South Vietnamese major, Nguyen Quang Nhoc, had murdered a prisoner in Nha Trang while U.S. Special Forces officers looked on. The execution, which took place around the same time as Luan's killing of the prisoner in Saigon, was substantiated. What's more, according to War Crimes Working Group documents, an American officer claimed that it was merely the tip of the iceberg, and that Nhoc and an American major, Wilbur Lee, had decided to kill 17 or 18 more prisoners to improve the body count. After Hue was retaken by U.S. and South Vietnamese forces, black teams of South Vietnamese assassins moved in, reportedly torturing and disappearing those accused of collaborating with the revolutionary forces, including women and children. In the wake of the Tet counteroffensive, the NLF's Liberation Radio reported, many heavily populated areas in Saigon, Cholon, Ben Tre, Can Tho, My Tho, and elsewhere have been completely leveled, and thousands of our compatriots, including many women, children, old men, and women, have been killed or seriously injured. The official South Vietnamese Army history largely concurs, reporting that more than 14,000 civilians were killed during the Tet Offensive, most of them by U.S. firepower. Another 24,000 were reportedly wounded, and 627,000 made homeless. U.S. military estimates of the civilian dead and wounded are only marginally smaller. Whenever the war returned to the cities in subsequent months and years, similar carnage followed. District 8 had been a rare bright spot in Saigon, part of a joint U.S.-South Vietnamese nation-building and action effort, in which fetid canals and crude shacks were replaced with thousands of new homes, a school, a market, and other public buildings. The neighborhood was intended to serve as the heart of a new capital and a vision of what a modern Vietnam might be. In the spring of 1968, its residents, perhaps the most pro-American Vietnamese in the capital, reported that guerrillas were infiltrating the area, but the government did nothing. On May 5th, revolutionary forces launched a mini-Tet assault on Saigon, meaning to demonstrate their resilience and ability to strike anywhere at any time. Their attack was swiftly answered by 5 days of airstrikes by American Phantom jets and helicopter gunships. U.S. helicopters were killing everything that moved, the Magnum photographer Philip Jones Griffiths later told an interviewer. Newsweek reporter Kevin Buckley saw the devastation firsthand, later recalling the many bloody sandals that fell from the feet of residents as they fled. By the time District 8 was secure, he wrote, close to 8,000 houses had been destroyed and at least 100 civilians killed. Another 40,000 people, about a quarter of the district's residents, were left homeless. In a secret memo to Vice President Hubert Humphrey, a top-level U.S. advisor also mentioned 2,000 wounded and confided, "There isn't one building left intact. Almost all were totally demolished by American bombs and artillery shells." John Paul Vann, then the chief of the pacification effort in the provinces surrounding Saigon, similarly wrote, "I estimate 15,000 houses destroyed. About 99% of this has been the result of overreaction on the part of U.S. and Vietnamese units." In a secret memo for Lyndon Johnson, his special advisor John Roach noted, "The communists are getting us to do in the South what we have refrained from doing in the North, city busting. Probably more innocent civilians have been hit in Saigon than in Hanoi and Haiphong combined." Outdoing the U.S. attacks on Hanoi and Haiphong was no small feat. The two major urban centers in North Vietnam had been spared full-scale aerial bombardment during Operation Rolling Thunder, which ultimately unleashed 640,000 tons of bombs against the North Vietnamese. Nonetheless, they had still been struck by many thousands of bombing sorties during that campaign. President Lyndon Johnson halted Rolling Thunder in October 1968, but it would prove to be only a temporary respite. In spring 1972, responding to the Easter Offensive launched by North Vietnamese forces, President Richard Nixon ordered the start of a new aerial campaign. That April alone, North Vietnam would be slammed by 700 B-52 raids, including a 48-hour sustained air assault on Hanoi and Haiphong. The following month would bring the start of Operation Linebacker 1, which escalated the bombing even further. The massive U.S. bombing campaigns that followed the Easter Offensive were not, however, confined to north of the demilitarized zone. 40 specially designed B-52 bombers, each carrying almost 30 tons of ordnance, unloaded on Quang Tri on a daily basis, destroying up to 99% of all buildings in the southeastern quadrant of the province. The provincial capital, Quang Tri City, was all but obliterated by the relentless assault. "Not one structure in Quang Tri City escaped major damage," wrote the Los Angeles Times reporter Jacques Leslie. "Rooms are collapsed like accordions. Odd-shaped plaster slabs that once were walls point into the air, surrounded by rubble. Here a staircase leads up to nowhere. There a house's metal frame, shed of its cement coating, holds up roofing that is still intact." The few buildings in the area that were not totally pulverized, such as the Bowday School and the Nato Long Hung Catholic Church, survived only as bombed-out shells. Another reporter on the scene described Quang Tri's capital as no longer a city, but a lake of masonry. Other areas of the province suffered a similar fate, with airstrikes and artillery fire wiping out homes and killing thousands of civilians. From the start of the American War to its final years, from the countryside to the cities, Americans relentlessly pounded South Vietnam with nearly every lethal technology in their arsenal, short of nuclear weapons, indiscriminately spreading death across vast swaths of territory. Such supercharged killing, so often carried out from the relative safety of a jet flying thousands of feet above the ground, a helicopter gunship hovering over thatch-roofed huts, an artillery battery miles from the target zone, a ship lobbing shells from offshore, undoubtedly saved the lives of some American soldiers. But the logic of overkill exacted an immense, almost unimaginable toll on Vietnamese civilians. U.S. commanders wasted ammunition like millionaires, hoarded American lives like misers, and often treated Vietnamese lives as if they were worth nothing at all.